This is Intervention, a podcast from the KTH Environmental Humanities Laboratory in Stockholm.
This episode of Intervention features filmmaker Robert Stone and his movie Pandora's Promise. Stone wants to know if the environmental movement got nuclear power wrong.
I come at this as somebody who's been anti-nuclear most of my life. My first documentary was an anti-nuclear film. I've also been considered myself a lifelong environmentalist. My coming around on this issue was really motivated after, you know, we've had 25 years since we've been really aware of climate change. And everything we in the environmental movement had counted on to solve this problem has failed. Everything we've tried has failed. And everything is trending in the wrong direction. So we need to start thinking about new solutions. And we need to do it quickly. According to the climate scientists, we've got very little time left. So we need to look at what are the available technologies that we have at this point in human development that can scale, that can solve this problem, that can replace fossil fuels. Nuclear, obviously, is one of them. It's a big one. But it's, ironically and tragically, it's the one technology around which the entire environmental movement is united against. And so my film is trying to start a discussion among those of us who care about climate change and care about doing something about this, to start this discussion. It's something we have to start talking about. I think there are two moral imperatives right now related to this. There's one moral imperative is it's incumbent upon our generation, maybe more your generation than mine, to leave a viable planet for future generations. We've got to solve this problem of climate change. We've got to stop using fossil fuels in our time. According to the best climate scientists, you know, climate science that we have right now, that's, they're saying we've got a limited time frame to do this. That's one. The other thing is we've got billions of people in the developing world who are lifting themselves out of poverty right now. We've got 2 billion people in the world who don't have any electricity at all. And that's another moral imperative. All of this has come together at a time of exploding population, rising climate change, ocean acidification, all kinds of problems that have come together. And the key element that ties all these together is how we produce energy. So if we can produce a lot of energy without environmental damage, then we can take care of these problems. So, and nuclear power has a role in that. But again, it's like the one thing we're not talking about. So I think there's a case to be made, and we make it in the film, that the initial rollout of nuclear power in the 50s and 60s was really an outgrowth of the Cold War competition between the United States and the Soviet Union. It wasn't necessary. We didn't need to accelerate the development. But as part of like the race to the moon or other things, it was a way of projecting, you know, the superiority of one society over another. And I think we raced the technology out too quickly. We committed ourselves to a reactor design that we have throughout the world right now, which has served us very well, but it's certainly not the best design that could have come along. It has a lot of problems with nuclear waste that people are upset about, and has been, you know, it is remarkably safe, but then you do look at places like Fukushima, and it's, you know, is it 100%? It's not.
So one component in Pandora's Promise, which I was found myself questioning at several times, was who are the users of this technology? Because it's very much still a discussion about the technology itself. It's one technology versus another one. But what type of society do you see would emerge from a future dependent on atomic energy?
I don't think it'd be any different than the one we have today, except we wouldn't be destroying the planet. I mean, the world is using more and more energy. See, this is again one of the many assumptions that we environmentalists, I include myself, got wrong. We thought that we were running out of fossil fuels, and that would cause other technologies to become more cost competitive, and the mere running out of those fuels would limit human development in one way or another, because we just simply wouldn't have the energy. So that globe, you know, that's lighting up at the end of the film, that's not a globe that's necessarily lit up with nuclear energy. That's a globe that's going to be lit up with fossil fuels, because we've spent so many decades now putting so much technological resources into extracting more and more fossil fuels. And fossil fuels are still the most heavily subsidized source of energy we have, believe it or not. It's amazing. That we just keep finding more and more of it. It will eventually run out, but it's not good. By the time we run out, we'll have destroyed the planet. So that's, you know, if you start to look at it that way, there really is no alteration of the path that we're going to take other than the environmental damage. It's not like providing the world with more energy is going to do harm to the environment. And in fact, here's another thing, is this was another assumption that I think we got wrong. We also thought that as you provide societies with more energy, it enables them to do more environmental destruction. And that's, so the idea of tying us to the natural forces of the wind and the sun was very appealing in that it would limit and constrain human development. What we've actually found in recent decades, particularly with what's happening in the developing world, is that the more energy you give a society, the less environmental damage they do, primarily because of lower birth rates. And that's the key driver. It's human population is the key driver of all of this. And if you look around the world, the areas that have the highest population growth are the ones with the least amount of energy. As societies get more energy, their population goes down, they lift themselves out of poverty, women get out of the workforce, people start to care about the environment. And this is happening in China. The Chinese middle class is not putting up with the pollution that's going on there. And that's part of what's driving them to renewables and driving them to nuclear.
All right, but this is still very much discussion of how nation states should involve themselves in the discussion of energy. But throughout history, the main energy usage has been within organization forms like small holdings or in family communities. So how would a solution relying on atomic energy make sense to a community or a village? For instance, one of the appealing aspects of the environmental movements has been the fact that individuals can commit to it. You can, for one thing, make your own consumption more effective, or lessen it, actually. Mm-hmm. But also the fact that you could produce your own wind power plants.
Sure.
But you cannot build a nuclear power plant.
You don't need to. It's not a one. It isn't an either-or thing. We need everything. We need lots of solar. We need lots of wind. We need, you know, massive investment in energy efficiency. We need all of that. Geothermal, hydroelectric, where you can. It's not just like one solution. It's just if you do the math about how much energy the world is using and how do we decarbonize? How do we stop using fossil fuels? You can't come anywhere close to what we need to get to with only those tools. So if you live in the country or you live in a suburban home, yeah, you can put a solar panel on your roof. That's great. But it doesn't work in a city so well. You've got a big apartment building, for instance. You've got a lot of people in a little rooftop. You can't power the whole apartment building with solar. I mean, this is, you fly over any major American city or any city, you know, all over the world, Shanghai or Tokyo, you know, it's just not going to be powered by wind and solar. You can't do it. It's never been done. The only two countries, it's worth pointing out, the only two countries that have ever decarbonized their electric grids are Sweden and France. And both countries did it with a massive deployment of nuclear power. No other country has ever come close.
When did you have this turn of fate?
Well, it was a long time coming. As I said, my first film was an anti-nuclear film. I made films about a bunch of other things. I wasn't thinking about this that much. It was in the back of my mind. But if you'd stopped me on the street, I would have said, sure, yeah, nuclear weapons, nuclear power, all the same thing. Let's get rid of it. But I was never an activist. I've never been an activist about anything. I'm a filmmaker. But my turn, as it were, really came out of making my last film, which was about the history of the environmental movement, and seeing that the tools and the tactics of the movement that had been developed in the 1970s to tackle things like air pollution and water pollution, and that had been very effective, had failed so much with climate change. And the other thing is I got to know a lot of environmental activists and environmental leaders, and every single one of them, if I took them out to have a drink privately or, you know, off in a quiet moment after a few beers, every single one of them thought that we were doomed, that there was no hope, that the climate crisis would overrun everything and it was all over, no matter what we did. And that really made me question things, because if these people who were publicly saying that we can solve the problem with wind and solar and efficiency quietly don't even believe that their own solutions work, why should I follow these people? And a surprising number of them didn't have children, which I thought was quite interesting too. The only people I met on that journey making that film who had hope for the future, and, or people like Stuart Brand, who was a big influence on me because I've known him for a long time, who said, you know what, there is a path out of this.